Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today is a New York Times best-selling author of 10 books, including Intensive Care, The Story of a Nurse. Echo Herron is a critical care nurse who recounts testimonies of real-life medical dramas experienced by nurses. I'll be asking her about unforgettable stories she collected from emergency room nurses across the country. Emergency 24/7 portrays 31 nurses, each with a distinctive voice and unique view of what really goes on behind the closed doors of the secret and chaotic world of the emergency room.
For the last 35 years, I have been repeatedly asked how nurses can bear to do what they do and why they choose to deal with the horrors and the sorrows they see each day. Since the why and the how are essentially the same question, my stock answer to both has always been that nurses are able to do what they do because they are rich in the gifts of healing, compassion, and love. Several of the nurses in this book made statements to the effect of, "We are nurses. This is what we do. It is who we are." In that simple declaration is the better answer to the hows and the whys. Nursing is a calling. Not everyone can do it, and most people wouldn't want to, considering that it is one of the most difficult and demanding professions there is. Practicing the art of healing is not always well paid. It is physically and emotionally taxing, sometimes dangerous, and it carries with it the responsibility of saving lives and easing suffering. The work is often stressful and at times disheartening. In the course of a 12-hour shift, nurses deal with life and death events that, unless you live in a war zone, most non-medical people won't face but once or twice in a lifetime. Most nurses are born to the profession, myself included. Signs of the emerging nurse can frequently be found in people while they are still very young. The individual who is drawn to nursing as a profession is often the child who nurtured pets, dragged home stray animals, and cared for sick and/or injured siblings or friends. For nurses whose family of origin was in some manner dysfunctional and stressful, they were the kids who were always trying to fix injurious or uncomfortable situations in order to make things better. Because these nurses grew up surrounded by chaos and drama trauma, the mayhem and adrenaline rush that comes with working in the critical care arena are, for them, a walk in the park. I understand that this is dime store psychology, but to explain the deeper whys and wherefores of those particular psychological dynamics is a whole other book. Plainly put, nurses are driven to do what they do. For a nurse, caring and healing others is the most basic mode of being. It is their nature. This, when combined with education, skill, dedication, compassion, and strength, makes nurses a powerful force. Recently, I saw a t-shirt with a saying, "I'm a nurse. What's your superpower?" And I had to laugh at the absolute truth of it. Nurses is not for the weak or the faint-hearted. Of those who go lightly into nursing on a whim or think of it only as a job and not a lifetime vocation, most will soon leave the profession or be drummed out one way or another. Nurses have the power to touch and change people's lives in a profound way. Nurses save lives, ease suffering, and dispel anxiety and anguish. In return, they are rewarded with a deep sense of achievement, fulfillment, and joy.
This is my guest, author and critical care nurse, Echo Herron. She's reading from her book, Emergency 24/7, Nurses of the Emergency Room. And Echo, it took a while for you to get this book in print. And when did you write this book? Because it sounds like you could have written it yesterday.
Well, this book actually has two different types of nurses in it. One is just the regular ER nurse who works every day in our ERs. And then 9/11 happened, and I managed to interview about 11 or 12 of those nurses who worked in New York City on the day of 9/11 and got their accounts. So that was 2001. It was right afterward. And I actually, my agent at the time showed this book around to the editors at Random House and Simon & Schuster, who were my publishers at the time. And they felt it was just too raw, and people weren't ready to actually read the behind-the-closed-door accounts of what had taken place. So we held on it. We tried again in about a year's time, and we sort of got the same story, although along with that we also got the editor saying, gosh, you know, those stories still haunt me to this day, and I can't stop thinking about them. And yet they did not want to publish it because they felt people were too raw and were not ready for it. When we showed it around again, my agent just said, you know, they're not taking this book, put it in a drawer, forget about it. And I did what he said. I put it in a drawer, but I did not forget about it. And in 2014, I took it out of that drawer, and I just decided I was going to publish it myself, which I did. And I contacted many of those 9/11 nurses to pick up and say, what has happened to you in these last 13 years? Where have you come from giving me those interviews then and it being so raw and so new? And what is happening to you now? And I got many different stories. But there was a thread that actually went through all of them. And when I was interviewing them the first time in 2001, it was very hard for me and for them, because it was the first time that they had talked about what happened ever. They didn't talk about it with their spouses. They hadn't talked about it with each other. They hadn't talked about it with any of the psych services. And so they agreed to talk to me. And I don't know if it was because I was in California, they were in New York, but they had a hard time. Many times during these interviews, I had to turn off the tape because they would just break down and start crying. They couldn't go on. And I found myself crying quite a bit, and certainly having nightmares, a lot of nightmares after these interviews were concluded on my end.
My guest is Echo Herron. She is a critical care nurse and author who has written a book about nurses of the emergency room. And as I read your book, which you wrote a few years ago, not that long ago, I read something that just came out in the New Yorker just recently this year, a profile of an intensive care nurse. And I thought, boy, this is just, it's a recurring statement, sentiment expressed by your nurses. And this was a nurse named Katie Chaplin. And it says, many evenings at 7, Chaplin can hear the cheering and honking, the nightly tribute to the essential workers who are keeping the city alive. The sound often makes her tear up with gratitude, but she's wary when she hears platitudes about the heroic work of healthcare professionals. She doesn't want to be glorified all of a sudden. This is what we train to do, she says. This is what we do. That was true a year ago, and it will be true a year from now.
Right.
And that sounds...
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what almost every one of these 9/11 nurses, and actually some of the non-9/11 nurses that I write about in this book, that's exactly what they said. We aren't heroes. Please stop with the heroic stuff. This is what we do. This is who we are. And I can attest to that, having been an ER nurse for so long. And as I said, people would always say, how can you do that? And it's like, this is what we do. We're not just trained for it. I have always said, much to the dismay of the nursing academia, that nursing is a calling. You are born to be a nurse. It is an amazing profession, and it's like no other. It is the most incredible profession there could ever be, because it's difficult. You're dealing with life and death every day, all day. That's what we do. When we are working in a hospital, in an ER especially, the nurse is the very first line of defense. We are the ones that are at your bedside at 2 and 3 in the morning watching over you. We are the ones who have that sixth sense that we develop over our years in nursing. When we can walk into a room and see somebody on that gurney or in that bed, and they're watching television or they're talking to their loved ones, and you just know. You can tell by the way they look, by the way they're presenting. It doesn't have anything to do with their vital signs. And you just know. It's like, uh-oh, something's different here. And, you know, it's like you're on alert. And that sixth sense has saved many people's lives.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll hear more stories from nurse and best-selling author Echo Herron. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, critical care nurse and author Echo Herron. The title of her book is Emergency 24/7. And Echo, you assign names to all of your stories except one. And this, you just label anonymous.
Right.
It says ground zero. And this nurse said, the only reason I work as an ER nurse is because it's a diversion. I think ER nursing is a thankless job. I respect the nurses who work ER, but I have to be honest, my first loyalty goes to working in the field as a paramedic.
Right. And it's interesting because the reason this person was anonymous in this book is this was a very, very difficult interview to do. Probably one of the hardest I've ever had in any of my books. And that was partially because when I talked to her, I believe, you know, my ER nurse sort of kicked in right away that she was suffering from PTSD and was, in fact, in the middle of having a bit of a breakdown at the time.
And you don't say any of this in your book.
Now, no.
Because the story is told in this nurse's words.
That is told in her words. And I instead of being the interviewer, I actually clicked into nurse mode, and I talked to her for a while, and I suggested that she might want to see someone, and I told her what I was hearing and from her, and she refused. Like I said, she was kind of in the depths, but I did ask her to tell me the story of her day, and her story was actually one of the most dynamic and difficult to hear. She was actually at ground zero when the building fell, one of the buildings fell. And she was in the middle of carrying an unconscious woman out of the rubble of the other building. And
you want to just read in her words? This is in your book.
Yeah.
And just, she said, I was appointed to make sure the seriously injured people were transported.
Right.
This is on September the 11th.
Right.
And, would you like to read?
Let me read
her work.
Right. She talks about a little bit further down. She talks about how this one woman was lying in the middle of the street. And so they picked her up, and she said, we were carrying her out of there when I heard a high-pitched screeching noise that had an underlying thunder to it. Some people thought it was a nuclear blast, but I thought it was a low-flying plane coming in to destroy the remaining survivors. Even though anything was possible at that point, nobody thought it was the sound of the World Trade Center collapsing. One of the EMTs screamed at us to run. There was no time to take any patients, so we dropped the woman we were carrying and started to run. I'm going to stop right there for a second, and just to tell you that that was one thing that this woman could not get out of her head, is the fact that they had dropped her, and I think she was suffering from a great deal of guilt. We left a lot of patients at that triage site. I don't know how many of them died. I can't think about that. When I got to Fulton Street, I looked over my shoulder in time to see a mountainous cloud of debris coming right at me. I was overtaken by it just as I made it to Broadway. I reached for the wrought iron fence surrounding St. Paul's Chapel and prepared for the impact of the implosion concussion. The second my hand grabbed that fence, a powerful wind hit me. I don't know how I was able to hold on, but I did. The strange thing was that after that horrendous blast of wind, there was complete and utter silence. Never in all my life could I remember the world being so silent. There was no question in my mind that I was going to die. It was like a car accident where it's over in an instant. This was a drawn out, prolonged expanse of time in which you know you are going to be dead in a few moments. I didn't want to die alone, so I reached out and said to someone next to me, please hold my hand. A woman took hold of my hand, and all around me, I could hear voices saying very quietly, I can't breathe. Please help me. I'm dying. I tried to take a breath and couldn't because the air was solid with particles. It was pitch black, and I knew in that instant that death was there for me. So I prayed to God to let me live. Just as I finished this small prayer, I saw a very bright light. I was wearing a helmet with a visor that partially covered my face, so I pulled my shirt up over the bottom of my face and began to breathe through the fabric. When I opened my eyes, the light was gone, and it was dark, but not as black as it had been. So I left there and started walking fast as I dared.
This is critical care nurse and best-selling author Echo Herron. And she has written a book, Emergency 24/7, Nurses of the Emergency Room. And a lot of the stories she collected were from nurses who had been in New York City on 9/11. And this was in the case with this nurse whose words Echo just read. So do you know what happened to this woman?
I do not. It's interesting because she was actually chosen to be in another book. And I contacted the authors of that book. I actually knew them already from something else. Anyway, so I had talked to them, and they said the same thing I did. It was extremely difficult getting this person to explain or tell what happened to her that day. And they also thought she was suffering from PTSD, as they all were, actually. But she was, I think, in the middle of having a breakdown. So, but they had lost touch with her, and I did too. And I had reached out to her, obviously, in 2013 and 14, and she never responded.
I'd like to you to tell us about a nurse, Mick, and I'm a little reluctant to read what Mick says because, I realized, okay, this person had been a fireman and became an EMT and then a paramedic, finally an ER tech, and he married an ER nurse and decided to go to nursing school.
Right.
So if he has this background, I'm kind of cutting some slack when he says, as far as I was concerned, nursing school was worthless. Oh my gosh. He said, they stressed the most ridiculous things like 2 weeks on how to make a bed instead of teaching the really useful bedside skills, like what to do when your patient stops breathing.
Yeah. Well, he was he had been a paramedic, or he had been a fireman before. So, you know, he got to see the real nitty gritty, and he had also been a paramedic. So they are dealing with disaster in the raw. So they're out on the street, and they're dealing with those vehicular accidents and all of that. So when he went to nursing school, and they start you out, of course, very slowly, they don't want to hit you all at once with that chaos at the bedside. And that's probably why he felt the way he did, because he'd already been in the chaotic part of taking care of people. He'd already seen the worst of the worst. And it was just too slow for him. For nursing students going into it for the first time, and they have no experience with working in a healthcare setting at all, let alone the ER. That slow start and that build up to getting used to taking care of patients, and this is what happens in an emergency, that's part of the education, and that's the building of skills begins then. So.
Yeah, because of his background, I thought, well, that's why he can say that, because he already had experience. And then he does go on to say that he noticed that physicians are more polite to him than they are mm-hmm. to the female nurses. Mm. They'll belittle a female nurse and would never try that on me.
Right.
And he does say it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that I'm 6'4 and weigh over 300 pounds.
Correct. I think there has been a struggle. I mean, let's look at it this way. Nursing is 97% female women who go into this profession, and 3% men. But I know that back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, when I was still in the hospital practicing, it was very much you were still not part of the healthcare team. You were looked at as just a nurse, which is what I ended up being a spokesperson for nurses and patients' rights. And it was something where the nurses, even in the with the administration, the nurses were the lowest man on the totem pole, and which is pretty bad considering that nurses are the patient's first line of defense. But frequently, I think back then, doctors who were men didn't see nurses as that invaluable team member that they are. But you have to think of it this way. I think this is why nurses really resented that, was the fact that you are with that patient constantly. You're with that patient 24/7. The doctor might stop in a couple of times and say, what's going on? What's happening? And you're the one who knows what is happening. You're the one who is there. You are everything to that patient. Mother, sister, confessor. You're there. You are the person that they say, I'm in pain. I'm suffering. Please help me. And it's pretty amazing that I think in a lot of hospitals, nurses are seen as the low person on the totem pole, as I said. But this brings me to talking a little bit about what's going on today with the COVID-19 and nurses in hospitals here. Whereas right here in California, there was an incident in Southern California where a hospital refused to give the nurses any masks to wear, and said that it would make the patients feel bad or frighten the patients. So these nurses said, oh, no, we have to have this protective mask. And it was like, no. So what they did is they went in and they went out, they got their own masks and started wearing them. And the administration said, no, you can't wear those. And it's going to make the patient feel bad. And if you do that, we are not only going to fire you, we are going to take your license away from you. Of course, this story went viral, and nurses in the general public are still extremely well thought of. And the administration was chastised. The doctors there, much to their credit, were just flabbergasted by the fact that they were allowed to have the protective masks, but not the nurses. And they actually stood behind the nurses and said, you know, you must let them wear wear masks to protect themselves from this.
Well, that was kind of an exception. Mick says female nurses simply don't stick together when it comes to forcing a positive change. So here was a case when the nurses did force a positive change.
And I would have to say, you know, you have to remember I did this. I actually got his story probably back in 2000. And things are much different now. Nurses have learned to speak out. With my very first book, when it came out, the administration where I worked would not allow anyone to bring it into the hospital. They condemned me for speaking out for nurses' rights and to tell everyone how important and how amazing nurses are and what it is they actually do. But they have learned, and I think they saw me sticking my neck out. I think my book was the very first one of its kind out there. And so they began to speak out. And slowly, you know, we have our unions, we have our nursing associations who are very, very strong, especially in California. California has one of the strongest nursing unions in the United States. And there are many who states who follow them. So it's a time when I did a lot of these interviews, it was a time when nurses couldn't really speak out for themselves and their profession.
My guest is Echo Herron, and she has written a book about emergency room nurses called Emergency 24/7. A retired nurse friend of mine says, he quotes this often, doctors cure, nurses care.
Right.
And that becomes evident in your stories.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to get back to the story that Mick tells, because here's this guy who's so serious and he's bringing up all these points that are so serious. And so we start reading what happens with a patient. And would you read his words?
Yes.
This is Mick now.
This is Mick, and he's taking care of a 75-year-old woman who came in with a bad case of bronchitis and flu. While I was starting the intravenous line, we chatted about her grandkids and her garden and how she loved to play bingo at her church. As I recall, she was really into the whole bingo thing because she got so excited about it, I had to steer her to some other subject. She did tell me, however, that she played 6 or 7 bingo cards at a time, so I figured she had to be pretty sharp. By most social standards, she was lucid, alert, and quite normal, which is more than I can say for 90% of the patients we see. I moved on to my next patient, and about a half hour later, I returned to the old lady's treatment room to check on her IV. It was hard not to notice that she was agitated and muttering obscenities under her breath. There was no trace of her previously sweet and cheerful demeanor. In just 30 minutes, she changed from an endearing bingo-playing church lady to Cruella de Vil. Thinking she might be having an adverse reaction to the antibiotic, I slowed her IV and did another set of vital signs. When I saw that everything was within normal range, I chalked up her education up to the hospital atmosphere and passed it off. I charted her vital signs, and as I was leaving the room, she yelled at the top of her lungs, "And keep those damn clowns out of my room. I hate clowns. Tell them to do their cartwheels in somebody else's room." My first thought was, okay, I guess I'd better report that her orientation level has slipped a few notches. I had the clerk page her doctor, then told the charge nurse that the lady was getting confused and we probably needed to get a blood oxygen level to make sure she was getting enough oxygen to her brain. I checked through her history to make sure we hadn't overlooked something, but there was nothing about her being confused or having any issues with dementia previous to this ER visit. When her physician returned my call, I explained that his patient had hallucinated seeing clowns in her room. He was totally baffled. The woman, a longtime patient of his, had never before exhibited any signs of dementia, and none of the medications we'd given her could have caused the confusion. He ordered some stat blood work and said he'd be right in to check on her. As I turned to tell the clerk what the doc had ordered, 5 clowns in full clown regalia came cartwheeling through the center of the ER lobby. That day, we submitted a formal request to the administration to please warn us the next time they recruited volunteers from the local clown school to cheer up the patients.
What makes it doubly funny is that we're reading along, we're falling for it, we're along with Mick. Yeah, this woman has just turned psychotic, and then the joke's on us,
right? Yeah. So one thing I wanted to say too about your friend is that I believe that the nurses are the healers. I believe they are the true healers. And I have always said that. And I think most nurses know that to be true, because we are the hands-on people at all times. So it's we do heal. It's part of that whole spectrum of what a nurse is.
After a break, Echo Heron and I will be back to talk more about the experiences of nurses in the emergency room. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is a critical care nurse and best-selling author who has written a book about nurses of the emergency room. Well, right now, for example, I'm thinking of Ann Carroll, who was at Ground Zero, and she was ICU, ER, a flight transport nurse.
Right.
And do you have anything, background you'd like to give for Carroll before you read her words?
She was a very strong person, a very giving person. And she said she's the type of nurse who gives the patients my home phone number. So she took care of her many brothers and sisters while she was growing up. And she had what decided her to be a nurse was she was a third year med student. And then she ended up in the hospital for something. And she saw what the doctors did, and she saw what the nurses did. And she decided right then and there. She was a very hands-on, compassionate person. The doctors were more the diagnosticians, and she knew that she wanted to be that hands-on person.
Yeah, because she says, the doctors are too detached. I'm not a detached person.
Correct.
So, and she says, I love nursing, even though the docs have all the power, unfortunately, much misplaced.
Yeah.
And then she says, if I had the power, I'd make it mandatory that doctors would have to work as nurses for 5 years before they could practice as physicians.
Right.
I mean, that's not going to happen, but wouldn't that be?
There is a person in this book who a guy who was a nurse for about 5 years and went on to become a doctor. And once he became a doctor, he wanted to go back to being a nurse.
Well, tell us then, or read Anne's words, if you would.
Sure.
She's in New York on 9/11.
Right. And she she was assigned, she flew from California, from Las Vegas. She flew from there and went to New York City and just said, here I am. I'm a critical care nurse. Put me to work. And so they assigned her to Ground Zero. She says, to be honest, I never thought I'd get out of there alive. It was a dangerous situation. We were walking in the dark over those cables and wires. Some of those buildings were so unstable, and with all that big equipment swinging around the rubble, I needed an extra pack to carry the supplies in and out of the pile. So I scrounged around PS 234. That was a school that was nearby Ground Zero and where she actually slept in the basement of that school, and found a boy's Superman backpack in the principal's office. I used that backpack the whole time I was there. When I left, I wrote a letter to the pack's owner, which, according to the name on the inside, was Nicholas. I told him how important his backpack had been and that it had helped a lot of rescue workers. I added that I was hoping it would get him out of any trouble he was in with the principal. That same night, I walked into a first or second grade classroom. On the blackboard, written in block letters, I found, "Today is Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. We will go to recess after we..." The teacher was probably writing that when the first plane hit. What really got to me was that these kids had a perfect view of the World Trade Towers. One of the teachers who came down to check on things in the school said that the children thought the people jumping out of the buildings were birds that were on fire. What an image.
This is critical care nurse and best-selling author Echo Herron, reading from her book, Emergency 24/7. One thing that I noticed that comes up, she says, I was hoping, she said, she wrote on the backpack, it helped a lot of rescue workers. And these
nurses in the emergency room were all prepared for more patients. And what they got were rescue workers. And why rescue workers and firemen? Why not patients who were, well, they did get burned patients.
Yes. A lot of people came in, a lot of survivors of those attacks came in to the ER and the burn centers in the first 3 to 4 hours. And then there were no more. And that's called, you get the first wave. And then in any disaster like this, there is no second wave. And that really depressed the nurses because they knew what that meant. And what that meant was the rest of the people were dead and there would be no more survivors. I had first one of these books that I did, Intending Lives, my center part of my book was the Oklahoma City nurses. And that was the one thing that pulled them down as well, is that first wave. And you think, oh, this is going to go on for days. And it doesn't, because people aren't pulled out of the rubble after those first few hours. If you're not out by then you're not going to get out. The rescue workers that she was tending to, these were the people going through the rubble. They were trying to clear some of it away. They were mostly looking for bodies, as they say in this book, parts of bodies, so that they could put them up for some sort of identification of who was in there. And there was a lot of, with the rescue workers, well, with the survivors, there were a lot of burns, certainly, a lot of crush injuries, a lot of eye injuries. With the rescue workers and the firemen and all of them, they had serious eye injuries, or from the dust and the ash, which was so prevalent in the air that Ann Carroll was a very healthy person when she went down there. She spent 3.5 weeks at Ground Zero. And when I talked to her 13 years later, she said she was a runner as well. She was running 6-7 miles a day. When I talked to her 13 years later, she said she couldn't walk to the mailbox without getting short of breath. And I think many of the nurses who worked at Ground Zero and many of the other rescue workers that were there also have serious respiratory problems.
From the stories, they had serious respiratory problems, but also some of them were so seriously burned. And you have a nurse who was at the Cornell Burn Center in New York City. His name was Bob. And he says, burns are an entirely different world of nursing.
Correct.
And it's just heartbreaking.
It is. It's probably, besides dealing with infants and children, burns are truly the most difficult of nursing. It's so hard to deal with that kind of constant pain and disfigurement. And burns don't discriminate. It's all ages, and it's. It's really a very, very hard thing to deal with as a nurse.
My guest is best-selling author and critical care nurse. Her name is Echo Herron. And while we're telling the stories of, or you, the stories of 9/11. I would like you to tell us about Nancy Issing, who was at St. Vincent's Hospital. She was an ER nurse, and she was one of the ones that said she'd always wanted to be a nurse.
Yeah. So Nancy Issing was the very first nurse, 9/11 nurse that I interviewed. And honestly, I do not remember offhand how I got in touch with her, how I managed to get a hold of her. But she, you know, she was just the most, I don't know how to put it. She was a very quiet, loving person, but she had the skills, just the best skills as an organizer, ER nurse. So she, you know, she was assigned right away to be the manager of the different sections, because right away they set up all different sections. You know, burns go here, crush injuries go here, respiratory problems go there, the dead go over here. You know, you stand there, you stand there, you deal with that doctor, you go here, you go there. And that's sort of what she did. And she's very, very good at it. She's a very sensitive person. Certainly one of the most sensitive people that I interviewed. I wanted to, if you want me to, I can read that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you read in her words?
Yeah. So they get in this young man, probably in his early 20s. And she, as he's wheeled in, she sees that he is probably dead or extremely close to it. He was a crushed victim. He had been crushed. And so she says, even though I knew he was dead, we quickly get him into the trauma room to crack his chest. His arm was hanging out over the side of the stretcher, and as they were pulling him in way too fast, his arm hit the side of the cart. I screamed out loud, "Watch his arm!" I was so horrified that his arm would get hurt. It was crazy. His body was totally blasted to pieces, and I was concerned about his arm. I know it was an odd thing to remember, but I still see that boy's arm, and it's very upsetting to me. It was such an incongruous thing to say, because at that point, it really didn't matter. There's a long pause. The tape is turned off. I was on vacation in St. Lucia that December, and I was lying on the beach in this absolute paradise, looking at the water without a care in the world, thinking about how beautiful it was, and boom. The image of that boy's arm just came right into my mind. I remember being startled by it and thinking, whoa, where did that come from? It was so disturbing. You'd think other things would be worse, but that bothered me terribly. Looking back on it now, I think the paramedics and EMTs were so desperate to do their job to help save people that perhaps they imagined they felt a pulse and they'd pick people up and bring them in even though they were actually dead. There weren't too many like that, thank God. After the buildings collapsed, we didn't get many more patients. That was the frustrating part. A few times I went out to the ambulance dock on 7th Avenue and stood there saying, come on, let's go. Where are the patients? Why aren't they bringing us patients? The quiet was almost enough to make us want to go down there and get the patients ourselves. We didn't understand then that there wouldn't be any more coming in.
This is critical care nurse and best-selling author Echo Herron, and she's reading from her book, Emergency 24/7, Nurses of the Emergency Room. You profile a nurse named Jessica, and she started out as an architect. I mean, each nurse's story is different, but she started as an architect, and then she decided she wanted to become a nurse, and then she became a lawyer.
Right. Interesting.
Her path was,
yeah, a lot of nurses actually go on to become lawyers, so it's strange. I started out in the law and went into nursing, so, but yeah. Yeah, she was in love with her architectural business. And she made a really good salary. And do you want me to read this part? Okay. One day, my three-month-old son became ill, so I took him to my HMO ER. There, the doctor scolded me for being an hysterical, overreactive parent and sent me home with Tylenol. My gut told me he was wrong. So instead of going home, I drove to another ER. As I walked into the lobby, my son's heart and lungs stopped working. I ran to the first nurse I saw, begging her to save him. She took him from me and disappeared behind the double doors to the trauma room. After supplying the triage nurse with as much information as I could, I was led to the meditation room where a video had been left running about life flight nurses. While they worked to keep my only child alive, I sat there watching that video thinking that if my baby survived, I would dedicate my life to saving other people. My son made it through. So 6 months later, I closed up my practice and went to nursing school. I also volunteered in the local ER. And one night, a young mom came running in, handed me this limp, hypoxic baby, and started screaming to save her child. I took one look at that baby and got such a rush of adrenaline that I knew ER was the only place for me. I have worked ER for 15 years, and although I graduated from law school and now plan on specializing in constitutional and bioethics law, I won't stop working as an ER nurse completely. It's part of the fabric of my life. The best thing I've learned from ER is that no matter what goes wrong in my life, I know how to keep it together. Like most nurses, I am a survivor.
My guest has been critical care nurse and best-selling author Echo Herron, and she has read from her book, Emergency 24/7, Nurses of the Emergency Room. And your book is all the more timely right now.
Yes.
Echo, and we just barely scratched the surface of these wonderful stories you tell in your book, and I think people will really all the more today want to read this book.
Thank you.
Again, my guest has been Echo Herron, a best-selling author, her book called Intensive Care. But this book she was telling us about is Emergency 24/7, Nurses of the Emergency Room. Thank you, Echo.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.